Hi, I'm Adrienne Hill, and this is your Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of July 12, 2013. We're starting something special on the show today. For the next few weeks, we're devoting Marketplace Money to the basics. Concepts like banking, investing, saving, and credit. I've got questions about it. I know you've got questions. So this week, how we interact with money.
Money, 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 money. Now everything is just money this, money that.
Money can be exchanged for goods and services.
Yo, you gotta get your money back quick from people because people get used to owing you money.
It's funny because I'm barely learning the value of a dollar. You know what I mean? Like back then, I'll spend it on whatever. I didn't care. Even if I didn't need it, I bought it.
This look like money? Money be green.
My son is 2.5 years old. He'll crumble up a dollar and I'll just let him hold it in his hand to the point where he loses it. It means absolutely nothing to me anymore.
Money. It's everywhere. Music, movies, comedies. It's even got nicknames like Bucks, Cash, Benjamins. But if you, as that father just said, ball up that dollar, stare at it until it loses its meaning, you realize something. Money's just paper. It has value because you believe it does, and I believe it does. But why? Why do we believe in money? Adam Waits is a psychologist and assistant professor of management at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. Hi, Adam.
Hi.
So let's start with the really big question here, and that is, what is money?
Well, as far as I can tell, money is a shared illusion, just like many other things that we have. I think we have a lot of beliefs in various systems, whether it's the universe or government or organized religion, that really serve more of an existential function to give us a sense that there's some order in the world.
Now, are we all just sort of crazy or delusional to assign so much value to a piece of paper?
I don't think so, because I think money has been fairly useful for the past 2,500 years or so. It seems to be a useful system regardless of whether or not we are all crazy and this is just some illusion.
Now, how do we keep believing it? I mean, how come this hasn't fallen apart? It seems like, yes, the dollar bills in my pocket don't have value in and of themselves. Why hasn't there been a moment where like, yeah, this doesn't work?
Well, I mean, when you ask that question, I sort of wonder why I haven't lost faith myself. When I was a child, you know, money was very present. It was very visible. It was something you put in a piggy bank. It's something that you see and you store and it's very visceral. But when I now that I'm older, I never see money. It gets deducted. It gets automatically deposited. It's stored on a card and it's this invisible force. But I think, like I was saying, it provides this sense that there's some order and there's some way of measuring the universe. I think it makes things nicely quantifiable, which gives us a sense that we're living in a just and meaningful society.
How does sort of believing in this illusion and the value of money change the way we value and think about things and experiences?
So this is where things get really interesting. In psychology, there's been a lot of research on what are the psychological effects of money, and not just owning money, but the idea of money. And money, it turns out, has very profound psychological effects. It makes us feel more independent. It makes us feel more self-sufficient. And what that does at times is it makes us become more selfish and less altruistic toward others. The other thing that money does is that it inherently changes the nature of social relationships. So money can actually lead us to view social relationships in sort of free market terms, that people are sort of worth more or less than others. And what a lot of this research has shown is that putting social relationships or things that typically don't have a monetary value in sort of monetary terms, what it does is it corrupts those things.
That's
You're basically putting a secular value on something that is considered to be sacred. So a friendship, a marriage. This occurs in the domain of health, in the domain of voting, in the domain of religion as well. When you put a dollar amount on things that we're used to not assigning a dollar amount to, this completely changes the game. and leads us to think of these things more in terms of their market value than their sort of natural moral or social worth.
You've thought a lot about money. What do you think the future of money looks like?
So philosopher Michael Sandel has written about this extensively in a book that came out last year called What Money Can't Buy. And the basic argument of the book is that money and markets are now pervading areas of our lives that previously were not governed by money and markets. So he gives a number of examples, such as you can pay for the right to hunt an endangered species in Africa. You can pay for access to your doctor's cell phone number. You can pay for access to a carpool lane, even if you're a solo driver. And what this does is it exacerbates inequality, because the argument is that, you know, previously the benefit of being rich is that you could buy a yacht. Now the benefit of being rich is that you can have access to things and influence over things that people without money simply don't have access to. So I think as markets continue to pervade our life, we're going to have to deal with the effects of money on issues of fairness and issues of corruption.
Psychologist Adam Waitz is an assistant professor of management and organizations at Northwestern University. Adam, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And now we move from one money illusion to another, the view of our relationship with money through the lens of popular culture. Our wealth and poverty reporter Christy Clark has been watching a lot of movies and TV, noticing how economic shifts can be reflected and sometimes even shaped by what we watch. She's here with us to give us a little highlight reel. Hi, Christy.
Hi, Adrian.
So where do we start?
Okay, so let's go back to the 1950s for a moment. Remember that the 1950s were a key moment in American economic history. We were still, as a country, kind of working out this idea of what it meant to be middle class, which is a category that lots of people identify with today. But up until then, we'd really talked more about two different ends of what we now call the middle class. We had wage earners on the one hand, and then we had salary men on the other. And both these ends were reflected in Hollywood back then. There's a movie called Marty that came out in the early 1950s. Ernest Borgnine won an Oscar for it, and he was playing a classic wage earner. He was playing a butcher.
Marty, I want a nice big fat bullet, about 4 pounds.
Well, let's see now. That'll be $1.79. How's that with you, Miss Fazeri?
Dinner for $1.79. Nice.
I know, right? If we only could all be consumers back in the 1950s.
And what's a classic movie then involving a salaryman?
Okay, so one of my favorites is The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit with Gregory Peck.
You're not going to always be making $7,000.
I could be making less.
But you can't look at things like that, Tommy. You've got to believe that things are going to get better. Promotions, opportunities, some good breaks.
It's such an amazing 1950s-sounding optimism.
I know, but it was actually justified optimism. In the 50s, there were lots of good breaks across the economy. Upward mobility seemed really possible for everyone, so much so that the worlds of salaried men and wage earners kind of began to merge. And by the end of the decade, there was actually a sort of official declaration of this fact by the U.S. government in a Labor Department report released in 1959. And here's a woman named Kathleen Newman, who's a professor at Carnegie Mellon. She studies mass media and society, and she read a little bit of this report out loud.
Today, the wage earner's way of life is well nigh indistinguishable from that of his salaried co-citizens. Their homes, their cars, the style of the clothes their wives and children wear, the food they eat are alike and are becoming more nearly identical.
In other words, it's kind of, guess what? We did it. Everyone's middle class now. Yay! Yes. And that's the story that Hollywood started to reflect back to us. We stopped seeing many of those Marty the Butchers. We got lots of men in flannel suits, from Ward Cleaver in Leave It to Beaver all the way to Dr. Huxtable in The Cosby Show.
In his sweaters.
Right. Yes. They were actually sweaters, but there's a little white collar peeking out of them.
But Chrissy, I mean, for a while at least, Hollywood's version of the middle class then made some sense. I mean, wages for average workers were rising, and a blue-collar job could get you a lot of the stuff that a white-collar job could, right?
Right, right, for a while. But by the late 70s, that trend was kind of starting to reverse, though we weren't paying attention to it right away. And since then, the gap between those two ends of the middle class has continued to widen. Which brings us to another piece of tape, another story that I want to play you. This is from a set director named Rosemary Brandenburg, a Hollywood set director. She decorated sets for a bunch of films, including Castaway. Do you remember this movie with Tom Hanks? He gets in the plane crash.
He's his friend, the volleyball.
Right, exactly. But so before any of that happens, before he lands on the desert island, there's a scene at his girlfriend's parents' house where he's eating Christmas dinner. And so for this scene, the director asked Rosemary Brandenburg to make a typical middle-class dining room.
I made middle class in my life, which was old-fashioned granny lampshades and print couches and lazy boy chair, printed wallpaper.
Kind of a working class version of a typical middle class home. And so when Rosemary got the set ready, the director came to see it.
He walked in and just hated it. Said, what have you done here? I mean, this looks like grandma's house. I think he had in mind somebody with much more upscale taste, up-to-date furnishings.
She learned something not just about Hollywood, but about our popular understanding of income brackets.
You know, and it's funny now talking about this and thinking about stuff I've seen recently. I mean, New Girl, which is on television, right? You have these 20-year-olds who are working pretty low-paying jobs, right?
I think there's a teacher, a bartender. I think she's actually an unemployed teacher.
And they're in this amazing apartment.
Yes, like loft, basketball hoop in the back.
But I mean, this is Hollywood, right? It's about pretend. It's about dreaming.
Yes, and that is great. And I love escapist fantasies. But I think one thing that we should take a moment to consider is that seeing all this stuff, there's kind of a tendency to imagine that we live in this country where the typical family makes enough to afford all this stuff, makes $150K a year, something like that. And actually, that's really far from what's the case. Half of American households make less than $50,000 a year. So there's kind of this cognitive problem where we don't live in the country that we keep seeing all over TV that we think we live in.
Marketplace's Chrissy Clark from the Wealth and Poverty Desk. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Our relationship with money is complicated. I think most of us wrestle with the best ways to spend, save, and invest. And that's why we're going to look at some of the major topics in personal finance over the next few weeks. So today, we're starting with our relationship with money. We're answering questions, the ones you maybe thought you should know the answer to, but don't quite really. And we've got a great guide. Michelle Singletary is a personal finance expert and nationally syndicated columnist with The Washington Post. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here.
So we're going back to the basics of personal finance this week. And we told our listeners there's no such thing as a stupid question, which I fully believe. And so here's what they want answered. The first question comes from Michael in Los Angeles.
I wish I understood all those grown-up terms. I'm supposed to know what they mean, like escrow and investing. I'm an adult and I should understand these things, and I just know how to check the balance in my checking account and whether I have enough to make a withdrawal.
What's a grown-up need to know about banking?
Well, in terms of the actual banking, he's got a lot of things covered. You want to know what's going in. You want to know what's going out. You want to balance it, meaning don't just rely on what the bank sends you. Check it against the checks you've actually made or deposits that you've gotten out and look at it. And here's the thing. If he goes to his banker and says, I'm new to this, can you help walk me through everything I need to know? They will do that.
Without laughing at him?
Without laughing, absolutely not, because they understand that this is a complicated thing for a lot of folks. And I don't think he should be embarrassed. Go in and say, just walk me through everything. Is there anything that I should be particularly careful about? But beyond that, I want him to get a little bit more sophisticated about what he's doing with this money. So in addition to just writing checks and paying his bills, I want him to start saving in an emergency fund. I call it a life happens fund for the things in life that happens, like your car breaks down. So for me, banking encompasses not just your paycheck and what you do with your paycheck for your monthly bills, but how do you plan for the future? So the basics, get it from the bank. What kind of account do I have? Are there monthly charges? Do I have to keep a minimum amount to not be charged? All those kinds of things he's going to get from the institution. And aside from that, look down the road, short term. What do I need in savings? Long term, what do I need in savings?
And that brings me to the next question that we get a lot, and that's about budgeting. I mean, look, you're a grown up, you got to have some sort of budget, but are there basic rules? You know, we talk about spend a third of your income on housing or less.
Right.
Are there other basic rules of thumb we should all know when we're looking at making a budget for the first time?
Absolutely. Here's what I tell folks. Whatever you make, spend less. You got to live not at, I mean, it sounds crazy
it
and
sounds,
so simple,
no,
right?
It sounds simple.
But most people live beyond their paycheck. You got to spend less than what you make. It's just really key to being financially smart. And then you got to save. So for me, the first things that comes out of my budget isn't my mortgage, isn't my, well, I don't have a car payment, but, it, you know, isn't debt payments and things like that. It's savings, all the things that I need to save for. My retirement, my kids' college fund, you know, my life happens fund. But if you're not looking at that from the jump, that I'm going to be spending less, that's where you run into problems when you don't have money for things that come up that you don't expect.
Now, are there rules of thumb about how much you should be saving? I mean, how much every month of your gross income you should be setting aside if you've got that money?
Yeah, it would be easy if it was like that, but it really depends on your own life. You know, I mean, what kind of retirement do you want to have? Then you figure out how much you need for retirement, then calculate what you're going to be able to save on a monthly, yearly basis. So, but let's say people like round numbers, and so I'll throw one out. I say for retirement, you're probably looking at 8 to 10%.
Okay.
And then college, same thing. You know, how many kids do you have? What schools do you think they're going to go to? You know, for me, it was state. We saved enough to send my kid to a state school in cash, no debt. And so we figured out how much every month that we needed to save to meet that goal when she was a tiny, tiny person. She's about to go off to college. I'm thrilled to death. Get out of my house.
And did you make your goal? I mean, did you save enough?
We absolutely saved enough. I'm so happy. We invested it, we saved, and we have enough cash to send her, and she got some scholarship money. So we are doing a happy dance.
Congratulations.
And one of the calculations that went into that is that we told her, you can apply to any school that you want, but if you don't get any money to make up what we have in cash, you can't go. And so I'm going to be honest with you. She's not 100% happy that she's going to where she's going, although it's a great school. I went there, University of Maryland. But she's getting happy now because guess what? She's not going to graduate with any debt.
And so you told her no debt at all. You said you cannot go to a school where you're going to have to incur debt.
No debt. Not her or my husband and I. No debt, no debt, no debt, no debt. And we've been telling her that since she was a little person when she didn't even know what debt was.
Now, we've got a couple of callers on the line who also have questions. Elizabeth is with us from Chicopee, Massachusetts. Hey, Elizabeth.
Hello.
So, what's your question? What's going on with you?
Well, I guess I have two main questions. The first one is, do I need a financial planner? And if yes, how do I go about finding a good one who is going to work with me and my family's needs?
What do you think, Michelle?
Well, I'd have to ask her a couple questions. So how much money do you have out there to worry about investing right now? I mean, oh, that's kind of telling people your business, but.
Well, so I guess one of the biggest issues that we're trying to figure out is how to allocate money toward retirement and college savings and the Life Happens funds and investments. And so as far as investing goes, on top of all that other stuff, we don't have much, maybe $15,000 to $20,000.
Okay. Do you have a lot of debt right now?
No, just student loans.
Now, that's interesting. Why did you say just?
Well, we don't have credit card debt, and we don't have, you know, other sorts of types of debts that I don't feel like are easily managed. So
how much student loan debt do you have? I'm going somewhere with this. How much student
okay.
loan?
Well, I have about $15,000, and my husband has $10,000.
Okay. So, all right. So about $25,000.
Yeah.
So I asked that because, right, and you sound awfully young. Are you guys young?
We're in our early 30s.
Okay, all right, that's young, considering all where right. I'm sitting right now. So this is why I asked you all those questions, because I think in down the road, you probably will need a financial advisor because you're not quite sure what to do. But right now, any extra money that you have, I'd like to see you pay off that student loan debt. So right now, without knowing any more than I already know, the money that you have should be to retire the student loan debt you have, so you don't have any extra money to invest right now.
And so because we don't, then we don't need a financial planner. Pay that off, and once we're in a situation to invest, that's when we find one?
That's exactly right. Absolutely.
Okay.
And I mean, now, if you've got some money, you know, that you want to hire a fee-only planner, and, you know, they charge any, you could find someone who could probably charge you $500 to maybe $1,500 to do an overall plan. I don't have a problem with that, because that will give you a roadmap, not just for 2 years, but 5 years, 10 and 15. You can do that as well. But if they don't tell you to pay off that debt, then you need to find another planner, because listen to me.
Okay.
And in terms of finding a planner, ask around. Maybe you know some friends who have a planner. And that's the best way to find, because you've got a recommendation right there. I would ask, if you don't know anybody, you can go online. There are different organizations that you can look. And if there's not one right in your city, that's okay too, because everything's so electronic now that you can do things over the phone. Maybe one meeting if they're close by, even if it takes you an hour or two to drive to them. And then after that, a lot of what you're going to be doing is online and by phone anyway.
Okay, great. Are we allowed to interview them?
Absolutely. You most okay. certainly should interview them. And I would interview about three or two at a minimum. And when you interview them, listen to what they say. And they ought to match up with your philosophy. If they're trying to sell you a whole bunch of stuff on a regular, like, I know you need this kind of thing, then that's not the person for you, because they need to listen to you, what your values are, what you want to do. Do you have children, did you say, or not yet?
No, but we will in a few months.
Oh, congratulations.
Oh, congratulations. Oh, you definitely need to get that student loan debt done so you can start saving for college. So you want to listen to them and make sure, like, for example, when we interview planners, we needed to find someone who was okay that we tied. So we give a great amount of our income, about 10%. And we had some planners who were like, why do you do that? See, that's not a planner for me. Because that person doesn't understand my values. And so you want to look for that. And if you go online to different organizations, they have a whole great list of questions that you can ask for financial planners. I mean, bankrate.com is a good site for, you know, what kind of questions you should ask financial planners. And definitely interview them.
Great. All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Elizabeth, I hope that helps.
It does. Thank you very much.
All right. So, Michelle, we've got time for one more question. We've got Carolyn with us now from Rochester, Minnesota. Hey, Carolyn.
Hi.
So what's going on?
Well, I rather impulsively opened a credit card at a clothing store a few months ago and soon realized that might not have been the most effective decision for me, because I have several credit cards open that I hardly ever use. And so I was thinking about closing those accounts, but not sure how that would affect my credit score.
And this is a question we get a lot. And I wonder, because we're doing basics, if we could talk, what is a credit score and how does opening and closing credit cards change that?
Well, a credit score is how the lenders pretty much grade you on how you handle your credit.
Okay.
And so they look at how you pay your bills. That's the number one factor that goes into a credit score. How do you pay your bills on time? And how much debt do you have out there? So it takes that and another number of other factors and puts it into a little pot, shakes it around, and comes out with a credit score for you. I mean, that's the basic of how it works. And so one of them is how much credit you have out there open. Now, it becomes a negative if you're using a lot of that credit. So that store credit card that you got, let's say the credit limit is $1,000. Mm-hmm. If you're using all of that $1,000, that does not bode well for your credit score.
Okay.
You don't want to be using very much of it at all. It used to be like 30, 35%. Now they're really saying 10, 20%, because that means that you're, you know, you've got some debt out there. So do you owe any money on that store credit card that you opened?
No, I don't have any balances on any of my credit cards right now. I pay them off.
Oh, I love you.
How many credit cards do you have, Carolyn?
I have 7.
Okay.
Okay.
So no balance, but 7 credit cards.
Correct. And I'm just wondering if having fewer will negatively affect my score, or if having the accounts open without being used will have a negative effect.
Okay, so the good thing is you don't have balances on any of those cards. So that does not affect your credit score. In fact, it's good that you don't have balances. You might want to keep the ones that are the oldest and then close the rest. What will affect your credit score is if you had money owed on that and you close other cards, because then it makes it look like you're in more debt than you really are. Credit utilization ratio. So they're looking at how much of the credit that you have are you using?
Okay.
And so there's this old phrase that says the good thing, you want to have credit and not use it. That's essentially the ideal situation. So if you want to close that card, you can go right ahead and do that. You might see a little dip in your score, but nothing significant. So okay. Now's the time to do it now that you don't have any balances. So if you've got some major credit cards, a Visa or MasterCard or American Express, you want to keep one or two of those. Okay. You really don't need more than that because I don't want you charging up on them anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead and close them and you'll be fine.
Okay.
Carolyn, thank you so much. Good luck to you.
Thank you. Appreciate your time.
You're welcome.
And Michelle, our time is up, but thank you so much. That was a great 101 lesson in personal finance. I appreciate it. Michelle Singletary writes the Color of Money column for The Washington Post. Michelle, as always, a pleasure.
Oh, you're so welcome.
If you're like me, the more you learn, the more questions you have. And to that end, we thought we'd ask a few of our favorite personal finance experts for a summer reading list.
Hi, I'm Elise Glink. I'm a personal finance writer and the author of The Intentional Investor, How to Be Wildly Successful in Real Estate. One book I recommend is The Essays of Warren Buffett, Lessons for Corporate America, third edition. Anybody who has ever read any of Warren Buffett's investor letters, all of which are published, you can find them online, you realize that he is the master and considered the master of investing for so many reasons. But he has this ability to kind of look out and ignore technology and ignore all these hotspots and focus on what's really important and so crucial to what makes a company tick, what makes a company valuable to an investor, and how do you recognize that? So in this new collection, Lessons for Corporate America, he takes a look at a little bit larger public policy point of view. And while it's not going to help me manage my money better, it might help me think about finances in a little bit of a different way. So I'm about halfway through, and I'm really liking it.
My name is Paula Wethington, and I work at the Monroe Evening News in Monroe, Michigan, where I'm one of the reporters and our personal finance columnist. The book I want to recommend for your summer reading is Financial Recovery by Karen McCall. You're going to find she has a very refreshing look at personal finances. You're not going to be overwhelmed with charts and credit card numbers and spreadsheets and things that just give everybody a huge headache. She's going to ask, what do you really want to spend your money on? And then you go from there. If you want a look at how personal finance can really be suitable towards you, I think you want to read this book.
Hi, I'm Michelle Singletary. I'm a nationally syndicated personal finance columnist for The Washington Post. My column, The Color of Money, appears in papers all across the country. And I just write about personal finance. And one of the things I do in my column is I pick financial books that I think that are going to really help you. So one of my first books that I love, that I recommend to everybody, is called The Millionaire Next Door, The Surprising Secrets of America's Wealthy by Thomas Stanley and William Danko. This has to be one of the major books that you have in your library. And what I love about this book is that it talks about the typical millionaire, and it's not who you think it is. It's not J-Lo, although she's a millionaire, but it's an average person. People who've been able to save and work hard and become millionaires. And this is the secret. You ready? You ready? They don't overspend. They live below their means. They clip coupons. They wear inexpensive clothes. And they drive an American car. And what I love about this book, it just sort of talks about how all of us can achieve this status by just doing basic things with our money, like saving, like not overspending, and not trying to keep up with the Joneses.
But hey, you can keep up with these book selections. We've got a list of the picks at marketplacemoney.org. We've also got a conversation going on our Facebook page about your personal finance reads. My favorite comes from Trudy. She says, your own check ledger and your pay stub. Here's a term you hear a lot, the FDIC. It's key to your relationship with money, and it has been since 1933. Historian John Steele Gordon helps us solve a little money mystery.
Mortgage-backed securities to credit defaults to up.
Look what Scooby found!
Well, gang, it looks like another mystery.
If you're trying to keep the level of yield in your portfolio constant.
What do you think it means?
Subsidized, unsubsidized.
I don't know, but something tells me we'll soon find out.
The FDIC is the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and what it does is it insures the deposits in banks up to $250,000 per account. Banks have failed, and they do. In the recent Great Recession, as it's called, a couple of hundred banks failed, and the FDIC made their depositors' money good. The federal government started the FDIC in order to insure bank deposits, so it stopped bank runs, because what would happen was that people would hear rumors that a bank was failing, and they'd go line up outside the bank doors in order to get their money out while the getting was good. And so to prevent that, prevent a banking panic, they started the FDIC, and there hasn't been one since.
John Steele Gordon's latest book is Hamilton's Blessing, The Extraordinary Life and Times of Our National Debt. For the next few shows, we're taking a look at the personal of personal finance, answering questions and explaining the concepts behind the basics, how we bank, how we spend, invest, save. And technology is changing pretty much everything, including money, even what money is. So we've invited Bill Maurin to help us through the brave new world of alternative payments and alternative currencies. He's the Dean of Social Sciences and an anthropology professor at UC Irvine. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, we've talked a lot about sort of mobile payments and mobile being the future of where things are headed. Is that right? Is that where we're going with this?
Well, and mobile is really shaking up the payment space and opening up new vistas for innovation and entrepreneurship, I think. You know, people always joke around about how the mobile has essentially replaced the wallet as the thing that people fear losing or leaving behind most. Mm-hmm. People can go through a whole day without their wallet and not really stress out about it too much, but really get anxious if they don't have their phone nearby or if the service goes out or if their battery runs out or whatever. And there's some real possibilities there for mobile. Now, the challenge for mobile payments is that we have a lot of legacy systems, the cards. We have cash. We have checks still. They work pretty well. There isn't a pressing huge demand for any new way to pay. But there is probably for consumers a kind of convenience angle here. I can maybe only carry one thing around anymore, and that will be the thing that will be my portal for both information and news and email and now also payments. But certainly on the business side, there's quite a strong case for mobile, again, precisely because of the kinds of data that it allows folks to capture to learn so much more about consumers and their behavior and their desires and to start developing, you know, entirely new business cases around that data.
One other thing that seems to be happening, and I wonder what you think about its significance, is alternative currencies.
Right.
What's out there, and do they really have any potential to change things?
You know, there have been alternative currency experiments for more than 100 years. There have been small communities that have tried to print their own currency to use in local transactions. What we're seeing now, though, is a real acceleration of that activity in the tech space connected to mobile. And part of it has to do with the fact that mobile is using a whole different set of infrastructure from the traditional card networks. With the card networks, you've got what people in the payments industry call the payment rails, these sort of MasterCard, you know, Visa card rails, the Amex rails, and so on, which basically carry one kind of freight, the US dollar.
Right.
With mobile and with some of the online experiments in payments, you're having developers start to realize, you know, we control an alternative set of rails And we also have the potential to control and create our own freight that goes over those rails. We don't necessarily need to be having something tied to the US dollar traveling over those rails that we've built. It can be something else. It can be our own private token. So you've seen a lot of experimentation going on with things like loyalty points and trying to kind of envision whether or not a loyalty point could actually serve as a kind of private token or private currency. And the other thing, too, not to lose sight of, is that human behavior changes very slowly. And in the money domain in particular, we're all still carrying around in our, you know, cars and wallets and purses and pockets coins. And the coin is a, you know, 5,000-year-old invention.
Right.
It hasn't gone away. What's going to be interesting to see is whether or not some of these new payment innovators and money innovators are able to get people to make the jump away from using any kind of physical token altogether and to just let things happen, say, on their phone or let things happen in the internet ether.
When you think about sort of alternative payment systems, alternative currencies, this question about technology, what's it all add up to? I mean, what could it mean for us as a society?
There are certainly people out there in this space and some really important and big and powerful people, right? Like Peter Thiel. And Thiel's one of the founders of PayPal and has been really active in kind of pushing innovation in payments. But, you know, one of the things that he has in his sights and some other people have in their sights as well is ending the state's monopoly over the means of exchange.
Wow. Right?
Disintermediating the currency, creating a whole system of private currencies that can trade against one another, that a particular company could own, that it would then start to own customer relationships around if it partners with merchants, et cetera, et cetera. So that's sort of one vision of the future, right?
That's a pretty radical vision of the future.
It's a very radical vision of the future. And now we also see today people, I'm not good at this, but other people are, people who are really savvy at managing things like their gift cards, their loyalty points, their airline miles, and their U.S. dollars, and, you know, swapping and trading and taking advantage of deals when deals come up, you know, actually using coupons that get pushed to them through their mobile phone. In the industry, there's a couple of big questions, right? One is, will regulation just kind of squash this stuff? You know, regulators might be interested in curtailing some of this simply because there are actually a number of consumer protection issues. There's a number of risks. Like if I accumulate a whole bunch of American Express points that I think are worth something today, Amex could just decide arbitrarily tomorrow they're not, right?
Right.
And then I have no recourse. The other thing really, again, is besides regulation is, are people actually ready to start using this stuff for real and leaving their cash at home?
Bill Maurer is Dean of Social Sciences and Anthropology Professor at UC Irvine. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So that's really the question. Are we ready to change the way we interact with our cash? Daniel Egan is the director of behavioral finance at the investment advisor Betterment. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So first thing off, you've called yourself a financial technophile, which means you're probably well-versed in some of the alternative currencies and payment systems we just heard about. And I was wondering how those applications have changed the way you do things.
So this is actually a great point. The answer is, unfortunately, not tremendously.
Why not?
While I love being an early adopter, the fact is nobody's actually hit the holy grail of substituting for cash, making something that's much easier. And this is really interesting. When you think about the money that's been put into financial innovation over the past two decades or so, there have been tremendous amounts spent, which usually to the benefit of a very few set of people. So if you think about the fact that we can invest money to lay fiber optic cable across the Arctic Circle to make trades happen milliseconds faster, that's a lot of money. And yet, I still have to pay 2.5 to 3% on any credit card transaction. And I think that's where we're not seeing efficiencies and innovations that would hit the average consumer like you or me very well. The fact is, it is still easier to go into your wallet, pull out $3 cash to pay for a coffee, put it on the table and walk away, than it is to take out your smartphone, unlock it, get into the app, interact with the whatever vendor it is, and then pay for it that way.
When we do get there, I mean, what What challenges does that pose for having us be sort of mindful consumers, especially as we live in a society of debt and bankruptcy?
This is one of the key ones. I think we're going to really judge these developments and, you know, quote unquote improvements by how much they benefit the average person. So things like that track your purchases and your financial habits, things like Mint, the benefit to that company, the reason you get that service that looks at your spending habits is because they're able to sell that data onto somebody else who's going to use it to understand you better, sometimes for better, sometimes because they're going to refer service providers that are actually going to help you out a lot more. But a lot of times because they want to figure out pricing on various things. How can they figure out how to charge you the right amount? And I think, how do we compensate individual consumers for sharing that data with these providers who are going to use it for sometimes good and sometimes bad, is really the core question. Do you own your data, and how much of a benefit do you get from sharing it so easily?
Yeah, and another thing I'm wondering about is when I go into Starbucks, for example, and I actually have to count out the dollar bills and hand them over, you know, at least I'm taking that moment where I'm like, yes, this is $3 worth of coffee I'm buying. If I just have my phone in my pocket, I don't even have that moment of consideration. And I wonder what that means for us as spenders and as you think about behavioral economics. If even the hurdle of taking the dollars out of my wallet goes away, what's it mean?
I actually think – I'm possibly a bit optimistic. I actually think there's going to be an improvement there, which is that, number one, you can have a smartphone app that's going to say you've already spent $20 this month on coffee.
You know, cannot spend
going over your budget to do that in real time. And, you know, it can ping you those little pain points like, hey, this means that, you know, it's going to take you another 2 months to buy those new pair of shoes that you were thinking about. I also think that the way we think about that – so you have a sort of system of doing where, you know, I have friends who take out $100 a week and that's what they're going to spend that week. Now, I think far better is if you actually have something technological that puts hard limits on that and that shows you sort of your safe to spend amount as you go through the week. So I think that a little bit of setup on your part of saying, this is my budget, this is what I want to spend on various things, and having something that gives you that real-time feedback, possibly in a more informative or emphatic way, will actually be better than cash.
That's very interesting. So you could imagine a future where my phone would be like, no, you can't buy coffee. I've set some pre-assigned limit and my phone says, no, sorry.
I actually think that's where we want to go. Most people do a budget and it has no teeth.
Right?
You can set up a budget, but the fact is, if I spend an extra $100, what's my budget going to do about it? Are you going to, you know, come and break my knees? Of course not. You're just a budget. So I do think that getting to a point where there are hard stops on those things and where you voluntarily accept to have those stops is fantastic behaviorally. And, you know, as somebody who looks at and thinking about the behavior of people rather than just, you know, a pure economic view of them, these things are very interesting. I actually think about cash in the same way. So a lot of, you know, to your point that you just said, the basics is that with credit cards, if we spend on a credit card, the pain of payment is divorced from the pleasure of consumption.
Right.
Right? Now, the same thing is actually true a little bit with cash. Because in order to get cash, you need to go to an ATM machine. You need to deal with that. You have to find one that hopefully isn't going to charge you a fee in your area and sometimes does charge you a fee in your area. Take it out and then spend it later. So the pain of dealing with the withdrawal component of it is divorced from the pleasure. And I think that actually that's something that leads you to have more cash because you say, I'm going to stop by an ATM and then I'll carry the cash around with me. It would be much better if you didn't have to stop at ATMs to take cash out at all.
You know, a lot of these technologies are really for people who can afford smartphones and people who have bank accounts and have credit cards. And we know a lot of the population is unbanked or can't afford these technologies. And I wonder what the future looks like for them.
When you look at how these especially mobile technologies and smarter technologies have been used throughout the world and within America, they're accelerating the rate of adoption amongst lower income people much quicker. So probably the biggest case study of success in this actually comes from Africa, from places like Kenya, where they don't have a traditional banking sector. They don't have banking branches. They use their mobile phones. They aren't even smartphones. They use their mobile phones to process transactions and send money to one another. So they've actually leapfrogged what we think of as our traditional banking sector. You actually see the same thing or a very similar thing amongst lower income people here in the U.S. They're not going to pay for a cable subscription for high-speed internet at home, but they will pay for an iPhone and they will pay to use the banking apps on that iPhone. And I think that in terms of the pace at which these tools and services begin being offered for the very big people and they then trickle down through time to the average consumer, you can think things like cars and TVs, which were very high-end luxury items when they first came out, the pace at which the average consumer is benefiting from these these things is coming very, very rapidly compared to how they did throughout history.
Daniel Egan is the Director of Behavioral Finance at the investment advisor Betterment. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
We want to know what you think about these new technologies. Good, bad, or meh? Send us your thoughts. MarketplaceMoney.org. Money isn't just about how we spend it. It's going to be about who spends it, like these high school kids. They're learning a little about money in the real world, or at least the almost real world. Welcome to Finance Park, a replica city run by Junior Achievement of Southern California. Around the room are small storefronts. There's a Toyota dealership, a State Farm office, utility companies, a grocery store, a Bank of America branch. Students come in, they're assigned a grown-up job, salary, family, and have to figure out how to spend their money.
So if I'm down $274, like it's negative $274.
Right, it should always be a positive balance. So you have to go back and
Do something less?
Yeah.
All right.
It's not always easy.
So we won't go to the Clipper game.
Yeah, so cross out the Clippers game and do something simple like going to the park or something.
One of the students trying to figure out how to feed his make-believe kids and afford a car and a house is Todd. He's 16, from Burbank High School. He says in real life, he recently bought a pair of $60 jeans.
If I had taken this class a week ago, I wouldn't have bought the jean. I would probably buy a cheaper one because it's not a need.
Needs versus wants are a lot of what these young people talk about. And here it's drilled into them, money should be first and foremost about needs, something that can be hard for a teenager to really get their head around. Clayton is 15.
You don't really have to focus much on that, on the need and want. You just kind of focus on the want more because you feel like everything's supplied to you almost.
Daniela is 18.
They're just thinking about spending. They want to get that job so I can go to Six Flags, I can buy those jeans, I can go to Boba, I can do whatever, you know? So I think for me, I have a job, so I tell them that. I mean, with having a job, there's responsibilities too. You know, you do need to understand the importance of saving.
Her takeaway from the day?
Think about the future, not just right now. You know, I want those pants right now.
As far as that future goes, 15-year-old Clarissa is realistic.
I think I want to be a cheap person because I want to try to save as much as I can. Just in case, like, I lose my job or something, then what do I have? Like, if, I don't know, I know a lot of people who they just lost all their money and they have nothing to fall back on. So I think I'll lead a cheaper lifestyle just in case something happens.
These are kids who've lived through the Great Recession, who saw their parents or friends of their parents have some real tough times. And the point of the program is in part to show them that they aren't powerless. Kat Delgado Kirkwood is Senior Director of Education with Junior Achievement.
The hope is that they understand the power of decisions and choices and that they have that control.
She says her own commitment to teaching good financial behavior came from watching her family struggle.
Making poor decisions when it came to loans, you know, car loans, having to claim bankruptcy because you made poor financial decisions. And I saw the after effects of that. And I said, okay, I'm not doing that.
Kat says family, they've got a big role to play.
Sometimes I think as parents, we may be afraid to have conversations. We may not want to show the true picture of what's happening. But I think it's important to have open dialogue with your kids and start now. Don't wait till later on. Don't pray and hope that they're making smart decisions, but actually lay out the facts and let's have some conversations.
We'd love to be a part of your conversations. We're on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Piggy Bank. And join us next week on the show when we talk about savings. If you got any questions for us, send them on over. That'll do it for Marketplace Money this week. Next time on the show, questions about saving.
Why do they keep interest rates at zero and punish people for saving money and force everybody into borrowing money nowadays? You know, it's like nobody can put any money in the bank and make any money anymore. They force you into real risky investments and real speculative investments.
Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch and Nancy Fargali, with Lindsay Foster-Thomas and Daryl Perinata, and help this week from Raghu Manavalan. Chris Clark is our engineer. Deborah Clark is the Marketplace Vice President and Executive Producer of the show. I'm Adrienne Hill. I hope you have a great weekend. This is APM.